As the door opened, Falcon saw the same young woman, obviously frightened, and he saw the cause of her fright. A man was in her room, tall with dark eyes and a black sweeping mustache. He had a dark, very visible scar on his left cheek. The open window behind him gave Falcon a hint as to how he had come into the room. Although Falcon's entrance must have surprised the scar-faced intruder, he reacted quickly. Grabbing the woman, he pulled her to him, pointing his gun at her head.
Ah! Now don't you go trying to be a hero, mister. I think maybe you better put your gun down and get out of here.
No, I don't think so.
I said, put your gun down, mister. Do it now, or I'll kill her.
I tell you what, you let the lady go, and I won't kill you.
Falcon's words surprised the intruder, and he blinked a couple of times.
What? What did you say?
I said, let the lady go, and I won't kill you.
Mister, are you crazy? Do you see that I'm pointing a gun at her?
Exactly, and that's where you made your mistake.
You call this a mistake?
Oh, I do indeed. You see, you're pointing a gun at her, not me. I, on the other hand, am now pointing my gun right at you. I'll count to three, then I'm gonna kill you.
I warn you, mister. If you start counting, I'm gonna kill her when you get to two.
And I will kill you when I get to three. One, two...
Wait! No, stop, goddammit!
The intruder put his gun down and backed away from the woman. He put his hands in the air.
All right, I've let her go, see? Now don't shoot, don't you shoot!
So we meet again. I don't believe we introduced ourselves at our previous meetings. I am Kathleen Coyle, and this time I truly am pleased to meet you.
My name's McAllister, Falcon McAllister.
You're Falcon McAllister?
What are you going to do with him, Mr. McAllister?
It's up to you. I can take him to jail, or I can finish my count of three.
What? No! My God, Mr. McAllister, no! Don't kill him!
All right, if you say so. But it is tempting.
You were so brave to come charging to my rescue. I feel as if I should repay you in some way.
No repayment necessary.
But I really should do something. Oh, I know. Suppose you let me take you to dinner tonight.
I'm afraid I have dinner planned.
Oh.
Well, you could come to dinner with me if you like. It's the Stock Growers Association dinner and dance. You could be my guest.
A dance? Why, I would be very honored to be your guest tonight.
I'll call for you at 6:30.
Falcon looked toward the intruder, who had been following the dialogue between the two with great interest.
What the hell are you looking at?
Nothing, nothing. Look, why don't you just let me go? I didn't do nothing. I was just in the wrong room.
You've got that right, mister.
Miss Coyle?
Please, call me Kathleen.
Kathleen? You do know you're going to have to come down to the jail and file a complaint against this man. Otherwise, they'll have no reason to charge him, and they'll have to let him go.
Oh, don't you worry about that. I'll file a complaint, all right.
You got nothing to complain about. I didn't do anything.
Come on, let's go.
Falcon emphasized his order with a wave of his pistol. He started to walk the intruder out.
6:30 tonight. You won't disappoint me now, will you?
No, ma'am. I'll call for you. Say goodbye to the lady.
Goodbye, lady.
Sheriff Foster waded through the wanted dodgers on his desk.
You ain't got no paper on me.
Well, now, you don't mind if I look, do you? With a scar like that, it'll be easy enough to find out if I have anything on you.
My name is Johnny. Johnny Purvis. Go ahead and look. You won't find nothing.
After a quick perusal of the wanted posters, Sheriff Foster looked back at his prisoner.
All right. I don't have anything on you, so I'll just hold you for breaking and entering and threatening to kill an innocent woman.
I wasn't really gonna kill her. I was just trying to get away. Besides, I wasn't doing nothing. I was just in the wrong room, that's all.
I might believe you, Mr. Purvis, if you had a room in the hotel. But with all the wealthy cattlemen in town, there is no way a saddle bum like you would have a room.
Yeah, well, what about the woman? She sure ain't no cattleman.
Maybe not. But she has a room at the hotel, and you don't.
Sheriff Foster took a key down from the hook on the wall, then nodded toward the cells in the back room.
Of course, you don't need to be worrying about a hotel room now. I've got a nice cell just for you.
That night, the ballroom was filled with women in butterfly-bright dresses who bobbed and weaved to the music as brooches and necklaces sparkled in the golden light of dozens of candelabras. The men were well turned out as well, in tuxedos and suits, or in the case of the officers from the fort, in blue and gold braid with dress sabers. Falcon was enjoying his time with Kathleen.
I'm a performer, Mr. McAllister. I came here seeking employment at Turner's Theater. I thought I would be asked to sing, or perhaps do a few readings. I didn't know that the girls at Turner's Theater wore so few clothes while they were working, or that I would be expected to do private performances.
Yeah, the girls there do dress sort of provocatively.
Heavens, if I had thought you would see me in my room when I was so scandalously dressed, I would be much too embarrassed to... Oh. How ironic of me to think such a thing, when your first sight of me was all natural.
I should have knocked before opening the door.
Oh, it isn't your fault. And what's done is done.
Have you been a performer long?
Not too long. I know it is foolish of me, but it has always been my ambition to perform on the stage in New York.
Not foolish at all. Have you ever been to New York?
No, but I know it must be wonderful.
I don't know that I'd call it wonderful, but it's interesting. My brother and sister perform on stage in New York.
Your brother and sister?
Andrew and Rosanna McAllister.
Oh, my, yes. Yes, I have heard of them. You must be very proud to have such famous siblings.
Yeah, I am proud of them.
Falcon thought of his siblings. He could remember how, even before the war, they would entertain not just the family, but all the people of McAllister's Valley. Everyone said then that they were good enough to be professionals, but no one really believed the twins would actually follow through with their ambitions. After all, McAllister's Valley was a long way from New York. But follow through they did, and once Falcon went to New York to see him for the first time in many years. Falcon McAllister was not a man who was easily impressed, but it was hard not to be awed by New York. The streets crowded with steady-moving streams of conveyances of all kinds, from wagons to carriages to horse-drawn omnibuses. In addition, trains moved back and forth through the city, sometimes on elevated rails, sometimes on the ground.
What do you think of our city, little brother?
I'll be honest with you, I don't like it.
You don't like it, brother? How can anyone not like New York? Why, this is the most exciting city in the whole world.
McAllister's Valley's too crowded for me. And New York, way worse than that.
Andrew, were you and I ever such country bumpkins?
Surely not.
Goodness, Falcon, you are miles away right now.
Falcon smiled across the table at her.
Oh, sorry. I was just thinking of my brother and sister.
I would love to meet them sometime. How wonderful it would be to meet them in New York and tell them that I know their brother.
I'm sure they'd make you feel very welcome.
Falcon, it is good to see you, my friend. Oh, I'm sorry. You are with a woman. I do not wish to intrude.
The man who approached was a rather short, stout man with white hair, broad face, large expressive blue eyes, and a bushy beard that matched the hair in color and was squared off at the bottom.
You're never an intrusion.
Falcon stood and extended his hand.
I'd like you to meet my friend, Kathleen. Kathleen, this is Conrad Coors.
The Conrad Coors? The great cattle baron?
In my home country, one can only be a baron if one has inherited a title. A poor peasant boy like me could not be a baron. Here in America, I raise a few cows, and it is a baron I have become. America is a wonderful country.
Excuse me, Mr. Coors, but 100,000 head are not a few cows.
Oh? And you have been counting my cows, Fräulein?
Oh, no. Please forgive me for being so forward. It's just that I've read so much about you.
There is nothing to forgive. I was making joke with you. But one should not always believe everything one reads. You ask your friend about that. There have been so many, what they call, dime novels written about him that I'm sure every young boy in America knows about him, or thinks they know about him.
This is true.
Coors patted a satchel at his side.
Herr McAllister, There's something in here I wish to show you later.
All right. Oh, by the way, I bring greetings to you from an old friend. Captain Sean McTavish sends his regards.
Sean McTavish, you met? Oh, he's a good man. A very good man. Together we sailed when I was much younger.
Yeah, he told me some of the stories, including one about the girls in France.
To Falcon's surprise, he could almost see the blush in Cor's face.
Oh, please, do not speak of such an embarrassment in front of the young Fräulein.
Don't you worry, comrade. The story will never be repeated.
Sean is a good man, but he talks too much, I think.
Won't you join us?
Danke. I won't stay long. I know that with your lady friend you will want to dance, but there is something I wish to tell you.
Oh, you're welcome to visit for as long as you like.
Today, for the meeting, you were there?
I was there for a little of it. Though I confess, I left for most of the afternoon.
Did you hear in the talking today when the man from the meatpacking place says that he cannot pay so much for the cows because they do not weigh enough?
Yeah, I was there when he said that. And as much as I hate to admit it, he has a point. You and I both know, Conrad, that sometimes when the picking is sparse, longhorns tend to get a little stringy.
Yes, but I have a plan to stop that.
How are you going to stop a cow from getting stringy if he has to scratch up 10 acres just to get fed?
First, I have something I want you to see.
In the satchel?
No, that is later. What I want you to see now, you cannot put in a satchel.
Cor's held his hand up and signaled one of the waiters over.
Paul, the special beef, bring to this table now. And in 2 plates, one for the lady.
Yes, sir, Mr. Cor's.
I have a steak I want you to eat, Mr. McAllister.
Thanks, Mr. Cor's, but I've eaten. We both have.
This is not for dinner to eat. This is for you to taste. You and the lady. I want to be certain that you understand. Please, for me, I wish you to do this.
All right.
A moment later, the waiter returned, carrying a tray protected by a silver cover. Lifting the cover revealed 2 plates. On each of the 2 plates was a small but very thickly cut steak. Each of the steaks bore the striping of having been grilled. And even though Falcon had already eaten, the aroma of the steaks was irresistible.
Oh, my. Has there ever been a more divine aroma?
Oh, the aroma, it is nothing. It is the taste you must experience.
Falcon carved off a piece of the steak and put it in his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Mmm. Oh, heavenly. You must tell me what the cook did to make this steak taste so delicious.
Nothing special did the cook do. We cooked this steak as we cook any steak.
Mmm. No, it isn't like any steak. It's like no steak I've ever tasted before.
Cor's held up his finger and wagged it back and forth.
That it is like any other steak, I did not say. I said it was cooked like any other steak. But this steak is from Hereford cow. Hereford cows are much bigger than Longhorn cows, and much better is the meat.
I won't argue with you there.
In Laramie, Wyoming, in 1 month, there will be many Hereford cattle for sale, both bulls and cows. There will be many who are going to go there to buy some seed bulls and brood heifers so we can begin raising Herefords instead of Longhorns. We will change forever the cattle business.
You say many of us. Who will that be?
I will be in Laramie when the sale begins. Also, John Iliff, Cece Slaughter, George Littlefield, Shanghai Pierce, Alexander Swan, Pierre Wibeau, Granville Stewart, and Dudley Schneider.
The men you just named are responsible for almost half the cattle produced in this country. I can see why you expect to change the cattle business forever.
I think you should be there, too.
I'll admit that it does sound interesting.
If we are to forever change the cattle business, you must be there. You are an important man. When others hear that you are raising Herefords, they will want to raise them as well.
Important? Come on, comrade, you know better than that. When people hear the word cattleman, I'm not the first one they think of. Besides, with that list of names you just gave me, it would seem to me that you have this pretty well tied up.
But your name is well known, and if they don't think cattle when they think your name, that is the more better. They will think that even one who does not have so many cows can raise Herefords.
I have a question.
What is the question?
Why are you trying to recruit so many people? Wouldn't it be better for you if you had the Herefords all to yourself?
No. If only I raise Herefords, then the meat packers will pay me no more than they are paying for Longhorn cattle. And if I refuse to sell, they will not mind, because they will have other cattlemen from whom they can get their beef. But if all of us have Hereford cattle to sell, they will have to pay us what the cattle are worth. And because the cows are bigger, even the meat packers will make more of a profit.
I see your point.
It is not just the men I have named who are coming. From all over the West, cattlemen will come to buy cows. On that day, I believe, the little town of Laramie will have more money than any city in the West.
Mr. Coors, I can see why you're so successful. All right, you've talked me into it. I will go to Laramie to buy Herefords.
Good, good. Then there's a beer I will buy for you.
Coors smiled broadly over his success in recruiting Falcon. He reached down into his satchel and pulled out an envelope.
And now, this is what I want you to see. Tonight, before to sleep you go, I want you to read.
All right, I'll read it tonight.
It was a pleasure meeting you, Fräulein.
The pleasure was mine, Mr. Coors.
Don't forget, Falcon. Read. Tonight. Auf Wiedersehen.
I must say, he is a very impressive man.
Yeah, I am persuasive. I had no intention of going to Laramie, but he talked me into it.
Is it true what I read about him? Does he really have 100,000 cows?
I imagine he does. But let me tell you about the real Conrad Coors. He's lived a life that most men can only dream about. He was born in Germany, but at the age of 15, he went to sea as a cabin boy. And for the next 17 years, led the life of a seaman, sailing all over the world.
My, how exciting! But how did he wind up in America?
He just got tired of the sea. So he jumped ship in New York, where he did some work as a butcher, while also working occasionally for relatives in New York and Iowa. Then he began traveling around the country, selling sausages in New Orleans, running logs down the Mississippi, and working in the distillery. But in 1857, he became a United States citizen, followed by his trek to the West. If you asked him what he owed his good fortune to, he would say it was just luck. But anyone who knows him knows better. He's successful because of his intelligence, experience, and most of all, his hard work.
He sounds like quite a man.
Kathleen put her hand across the table and rested it on top of Falcon's.
But then I have heard the same things about you.
Impossible. You just met me today.
It is true that I just met you today, but I've known about you for a long time.
Please don't tell me you've read those god-awful dime novels.
I'm innocent. I've never read one.
Well, I'm thankful for that.
Are you going to invite me to dance?
You're as persuasive as Coors.
Later that evening, in his hotel room, Falcon lay on top of the bed covers as it was very warm. He read the report that Coors had given him. It was written in longhand, but the penmanship was sharp and very legible, making it easy to read.
A new breed of cows. Only a few copies of this report are being prepared, and it should be circulated with the greatest of care. A changeover to the Hereford breed is going to require a rather significant investment on the part of the participating cattlemen. It is anticipated that the bidding for the seed bulls and blooded heifers with which to start the new herds will be quite brisk. It is suggested that those who wish to bid have at their disposal at least $15,000. This information should not be shared with the general public for fear of making the cost of participation much higher.
Falcon finished reading the report, and he put it on the table beside the bed. Not expecting anyone at this late hour, he reached up to his holster belt, which was looped across the headboard of the bed, then eased the pistol from its holster.
Who's there?
As soon as Falcon called out, he moved quickly to one side of the room in case someone on the other side of the door decided to shoot toward the sound of the voice.
It's Kathleen.
Kathleen, is something wrong?
Falcon stepped over to the door. A pie-shaped wedge of golden light spilled into the room from the kerosene lamps that lit the hallway. Kathleen stepped into the wedge of light. She didn't see Falcon, but Falcon could see her. She was wearing a silk nightgown that clung to her curves in a way that hid nothing of her charms. and since he had seen her earlier in the bath, he knew exactly what those charms were.
Falcon? Mr. McAllister, are you here?
Yeah.
Falcon remained in the shadows alongside the door.
Why are you hiding?
I'm not exactly hiding. I'm just being cautious.
Why, Mr. McAllister, are you afraid of me?
Why do you ask? Should I be afraid?
Falcon stepped out of the shadows.
I would hope that you're not afraid. After all, I'm just a woman.
She punctuated her comment by thrusting her hip to one side and smiling up at him. Kathleen had put on some perfume, and Falcon could smell its scent. A touch of lilac, a hint of coriander, and something else. A womanly musk that came not from the perfume, but from her own excitement.
I couldn't sleep. I thought maybe, that is, if you couldn't sleep either, we might visit.
Do come in.
One week later, Johnny Purvis was sitting on the bunk in his cell when Sheriff Foster opened the door.
Out of the cell.
What do you want?
I want you out of the cell.
Johnny stroked his scar nervously.
Now look, I don't know what this is all about, but I ain't even had a trial yet.
You aren't getting a trial.
What do you mean I ain't getting a trial? Everyone gets a trial.
The woman whose room you broke into, she never came by to file a complaint. Without her complaint and statement, we can't hold you.
Johnny smiled broadly, then grabbed his hat.
So what you're saying is, you're letting me go?
That's what I'm saying.
I knew you couldn't hold me. I told you, I wasn't doing nothing wrong. I was just in the wrong room.
Yeah, so you said.
Wait a minute. What are you letting me go now for? It's about lunchtime, ain't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought so. I'm hungry. Why don't you wait and just let me go after lunch?
You aren't the county's problem anymore. You want lunch? You're gonna have to pay for it yourself.
I ain't got enough money for lunch.
Sheriff Foster reached into his pocket and pulled out a quarter.
Here, this'll get you a plate down at Little Man Lambert's.
One of the diners at the cafe stopped by the counter to pay for his dinner.
Well, that was a really good meal, little man.
Well, thank you, Mr. Farrell.
Farrell pulled out a roll of money.
Good Lord. That's an awful lot of money to be flashing around, isn't it?
Oh, I know. But it's payday for all my hands. Like as not, you'll be getting a few of them in here tonight. And that is, the ones that are still sober come supper time. Whenever they get paid, they like to spend their money in town.
I'll get some of it, I'm sure. But more than likely, most of it'll wind up with the girls over at the Turner Theater.
I don't doubt that. Well, the only young ones, I can't hold against them.
Johnny Purvis was sitting at a table very near the counter, and he overheard the conversation between Farrell and Little Man. Then, finishing his meal, he went up to the counter himself.
Was your meal satisfactory, sir?
Yeah, it was fine.
Johnny slapped a quarter down on the counter.
We have cherry pie today.
I ain't got no more money.
Oh, the pie comes with the meal. You already paid for it.
No thanks.
All the time Johnny was talking to the Little Man, he was looking through the window, keeping an eye on Farrell. He saw Farrell walk across the street and step into the livery.
I don't know as I've ever seen anyone turn down a piece of cherry pie.
I ain't got time for no more palavering.
The smile left the Little Man's face.
Well, then get. Don't let me stop you.
Leaving the cafe, Johnny hurried down the street, crossed over to the other side, then went between two buildings in order to emerge in the alley. Moving quickly up the alley, he came up to the back end of the livery stable. The corral of the stable was enclosed by a fence, and Johnny climbed over the fence, then darted across the corral to the big, wide double doors. He pushed them open just enough to get through. It was dark in the stable, the only light being the irregular, glistening, moat-filled bars of sun that speared through the cracks between the wide, unpainted boards. Johnny stood still for a moment until his eyes adjusted to the dark. Then he saw Farrell standing at one of the stalls, feeding an apple to a horse. Seeing a pitchfork leaning against the wall, Johnny picked it up, then started toward Farrell.
I don't know why I put up with you, horse.
Farrell was so engrossed with his horse that he didn't notice the man moving quietly through the shadows behind him. Johnny raised the pitchfork. Suddenly, Farrell heard something behind him. Turning, he didn't even have time to cry out before Johnny plunged the pitchfork into his chest. Blood oozed from Farrell's mouth as he went down. Johnny reached over and took the wad of money from him, even as Farrell's eyes were growing opaque. Sticking the money into his pocket, he left the livery stable. A train was pulling into the station just as Johnny reached the depot. He barely had time enough to buy a ticket to Boise, Idaho territory, before the train pulled out. As the train left, Johnny looked up the street toward the livery stable. He saw a dozen or more people gathered around the front, and he saw Sheriff Foster coming quickly to the scene. Johnny smiled. Farrell's body had been discovered, but he was safely on the train leaving town. He felt a tremendous sense of elation, almost as if he were drunk. It wasn't until then that he took time to count his money. He had $240. Gabe Harlan and Pete Ward reached the little town of Carrizo at about 10 o'clock in the evening. Carrizo was divided into two sections, the American section and the Mexican section. The two sections of town were separated by the Union Pacific Railroad, and though they were within walking distance of each other, so little interchange existed between the two elements that it could have been two different towns. The American half, on the north side of the tracks, had false-fronted buildings made of lumber flanking straight, well-defined streets. The saloons served beer and American whiskey, and the cooking smells from the residential area were of fried pork chops or chicken. Potatoes and biscuits were the staple. The Mexican half on the south side was made up of adobe structures, and the smells from here were spicy, with beans and tortillas being the staple. The streets were crooked and irregular, and the cantina served tequila. Tired and frustrated over a bank robbery that had netted very little, Gabe and Pete decided there would be less of a chance of anyone recognizing them if they stayed on the Mexican side. Gabe could speak the lingo, but Pete couldn't, which put him at a disadvantage. There were two men standing in front of the cantina. Both were wearing large sombreros, and one was wearing a serape.
¿Por qué ha venido aquí un gringo?
No sé, tal vez están perdidos.
We're not lost. We came here to get a bottle of tequila and a whore.
The gringos don't have putas.
Yeah, but all American whores are ugly.
Enjoy your tequila and puta, señor.
Si, señor.
Tequila, two bottles. Pick out a whore, Pete.
I heard what you said to them Mexes out front, but to tell the truth, I don't like Mexican whores as much as I like American whores.
It don't matter, does it? We're getting them as much for the bed as for anything else.
Oh.
Gabe woke up the next morning with a ravenous hunger and a raging need to urinate. The poodle was still asleep beside him. She had the bed cover askew, exposing one enormous pillow-sized, heavily blue-veined breast. One fat leg dangled over the edge of the bed. A bit of spittle drooled from her vibrating lips. She didn't wake up when Gabe crawled over her to get out of bed and get dressed. There was an outhouse just behind the cantina, no more than 20 feet from the door of the room. But Gabe made no attempt to go outside. Instead, he urinated against the wall.
Pete! Pete, you still in there?
Yup!
Pete had gone with his whore into the room next door.
Morning.
Hey.
Pete was wearing his boots and a hat, but nothing more. He joined Gabe at the wall.
What are we doing here, Gabe?
Well, I'm taking a pee. And it's a good thing you're naked, because you're taking a pee, too.
I know that. What I want to know is, why did we come to this town?
There's lots of Mex towns we could have gone to.
Yeah, but Eddie Jordan lives in this town. You remember Eddie Jordan, don't you?
Yeah, I remember Eddie Jordan. What are we looking for him for?
Gabe shook himself and turned away from the wall.
We need some money, don't we?
Yeah, I reckon we do.
Well, if there's something going on anywhere, Eddie's the one who'll know about it.
You mean like another robbery?
Yeah, only this time maybe we can pick us a bank that has more than $65 in it.
Are we going over into the American side to look for him?
Nah, we ain't. The whore is. Get dressed. I'll send her after Eddie while we have breakfast.
All right.
Puta. Puta, wake up. Wake up, you goddamn whore.
¿Qué quiere usted, señor?
What do I want? I want you to go find someone for me. That's what I want.
Gabe and Pete were halfway through their breakfast when Gabe's whore came into the cafe, followed by a tall, gangly American. The expression on the American's face was one of curiosity, since it was obvious he had no idea as to why the woman had come north of the tracks to summon him. She pointed toward Gabe and Pete. When Eddie saw the two men, he smiled, then came over to join them, taking a chair from a nearby table.
Well, I'll be damned.
Eddie picked up a tortilla, rolled it around some beans, then took a bite.
Gabe Harlan and Pete Ward, what are you two doing here?
Everyone has to be somewhere.
Well, you got that right. But as long as you're going to be in Carrizo, what are you doing on the Mexican side?
Well, maybe you didn't hear about it, but me and Pete robbed a bank down in Erastus.
Really? Then I'll rephrase the question. If you got all that money, what the fuck are you doing here on the Mex side of Carrizo?
We didn't get all that much money.
How much did you get?
$65.
How much?
We got $65.
$65. You robbed a bank and all you got was $65.
That's all the money they had in the damn thing. The point is, we did rob the bank, and it don't make no difference how much we took. The law will be after us just the same. So we figured we better stay on this side of town. Well, I'm glad you're finding it so damn funny.
I'm sorry. I know it ain't funny to you. I mean, you take just as big a chance robbing a bank for $65 as you do for $10,000.
Yeah. But what's done is done, and we still need money.
Look, I know I owe you $20.
Eddie reached into his pocket and pulled out a $20 gold piece.
And I would have given it to you a long time ago, but I kind of lost track of where you was.
Thanks.
Gabe took the coin and pocketed it.
Actually, I didn't come here to collect the $20. What I come here for was to see if you had any ideas.
Ideas? About what?
Come on, Eddie, don't make me spell it out for you. Because if I do spell it out, someone might hear it. Someone that we don't want to hear what we're talking about.
What are we talking about?
Come on, Eddie. I know you always know what's going on. Whatever it is, I want in on it.
Eddie drummed his fingers on the table for a moment. Then he nodded.
All right. I do know about something that's going on. And from what I hear, it's going to be a lot of money.
Who? When? Where?
No. I can't tell you anything yet. Not until I find out if it's all right to bring you two in.
What do you mean, find out if it's all right? You know us. Can't you tell whoever it is about us?
Stay here a few days till I find out if it's all right.
Well, how long would that be?
Hell, Gabe, you got food, liquor, and whores. What else do you need?
It's a lot of money.
A lot of money.
Gabe looked across the table at Pete, who had not stopped eating from the moment they sat down to breakfast.
What do you think, Pete? Shall we wait?
Oh, hell yeah.
All right, then. We'll wait.
You won't be sorry.
Established by a group of gold prospectors on November 22, 1858, and named after James Denver, governor of Kansas Territory at the time, the city of Denver had grown in just one generation to be the second largest city in the West. The city of Denver had more people than the territories of the Dakotas, Wyoming, Arizona, and New Mexico combined. Gilly Cardis had never been in a city so large. His first sight was of the railroad depot itself. He steps down, not onto a wooden platform from a single train stop next to a small depot as he was used to, but onto a cement walk that separated the train he was on from another train next to it. Curtis had to step quickly to avoid being run down by someone pushing a baggage cart. He happened to glance up then and saw that though he was off the train, he wasn't outside. Instead, he was under a high overhead roof made of corrugated tin and supported by a network of pillars and cables. He also saw that there were actually several trains under this roof. One train was leaving while another train was backing into the station. And his train and the next train over were just two of several trains that were in the station. The building was huge, bigger than any building Curtis had ever seen in his life. The floor was of marble and stretched over the top of the depot with a large dome. Looking back toward the door through which he had passed, he saw a sign that read, "Two Trains." On the opposite wall, all the way across the floor, beyond the scores of long wooden benches upon which passengers were sitting as they awaited the departure of their trains, was another sign. This one read, "Two Street." On one wall was a huge clock, flanked on either side by gigantic blackboards, upon which updated information was imparted to the passengers. One of the blackboards listed destinations, track numbers, and times of departure. The other blackboard listed points of origin, track numbers, and time of arrival. Curtis saw cities listed that he had never visited but had only heard about. San Francisco, St. Louis, Memphis, Chicago, New York, Boston, and Philadelphia. The depot was filled with people, and everyone seemed to be in a hurry. Gilly tried to stop a couple of people to ask them a question, but they moved on without responding. Then he saw two men who didn't seem to be in as big a hurry as everyone else, but were standing in the middle of the floor talking to each other. He walked up to them.
"Hey, can you tell me where I can find me a man calls himself McAllister? Falcon McAllister?"
"No, I don't think so."
"Well, how come you don't know? He's supposed to live near Denver."
"Mister, 100,000 people live in Denver. You expect us to know everyone?"
"100,000?
Shaking his head, Curtis walked away from the two. That was when he noticed a long counter topped by a frosted glass wall. The glass wall was interrupted every few feet by windows, and behind each window was a ticket agent. He walked up to one of the windows.
"Yes, sir, where would you like to go?"
"Well, I ain't going nowhere. I just got here. I was just wondering if you could tell me where at a fella by the name of Falcon McAllister might be."
"I'm sorry. I don't think I can help you. Next."
"Well, have you got any idea where..."
"Excuse me, sir, but I do have a customer, and there are train schedules to keep. Can't keep the customer behind you waiting."
Curtis walked away, then headed for the door under the sign that said, "Two Street." The street in front of the depot was so filled with hacks, carriages, buggies, buckboards, and freight wagons that it was difficult for Curtis to get to the other side. Curtis wandered around the city for the rest of the day, marveling at the crowds of people and the size of all the buildings. When it grew dark, he realized that he was hungry, so he walked around until he found a restaurant. A waiter escorted him to an empty table, then gave him a menu.
"I'll give you a moment to make up your mind, sir."
Curtis opened the menu.
Holy shit.
Curtis gaped in surprise at the cost of everything. He had thought that he would have enough money to spend a few days in Denver, at least until he found McAllister. But if the cost of meals in this restaurant was any indication, he was going to have to make up his mind whether he wanted to eat or sleep in a warm bed. For now, he decided that he would eat. But since most of the $31 he had stolen was gone, he was going to have to make some kind of arrangements. Now, normally he wouldn't even thought twice about staying in a hotel, but now he'd have to find a livery somewhere. Most likely he could sleep in the warm straw in a livery stable for free. Sometimes it would cost him a nickel or maybe even a dime, but never more than that. Curtis ordered fried chicken and ate heartily, breaking the bones and sucking out the marrow. Then he used a piece of bread to sop up everything from the plate. When he was finished, he paid for his meal and stepped outside. It was dark and foggy, and Curtis, who wasn't wearing a coat, was surprised by how cold it was. 3 days ago, he'd been fighting the desert heat. Now he was so cold he couldn't stop shivering, and he stuck his hands down in his pockets as he walked off into the night. A hansom cab rolled by, dark brown with yellow trim and yellow wheels. The seats were cushioned leather, and the passenger sitting in the back was wearing a suit, overcoat, and top hat. He had the arrogant look of someone who was not only used to such luxury, but accepted it as his due.
Stop ahead, Clarence.
When the cab stopped half a block in front from Cardus, he stepped back into the shadows.
You sure you want to stop here, Mr. Brooks? I can take you right to your house with no problem.
No, you'd have to go all the way down to the bottom of the hill and around the block, then back up again. I can just cut through the alley.
Yes, sir, if you say so.
Brooks got out and stepped up to the front of the cab, then paid the driver.
Your team was stepping out quite lively tonight, Clarence. I enjoyed the ride.
Thank you, sir.
Although Cardus could no longer see the cab in the fog, he could hear it as it continued down the street. He could see the golden bubbles of light that marked each corner of the avenue. These were the street lamps, gleaming yellow, though with a light so diffused by the mist that they provided little in the way of real illumination. Staying well back, Cardus followed Brooks for about half a block until he turned up an alley that had no lights on at all. Within a moment, Brooks was swallowed up in the night and the fog. Cardus darted up a side street that ran parallel with the alley. Then he came to a cross alley. He ran down the cross alley, then leaned against the cold, damp brick wall, waiting for Brooks to arrive. The fog was so thick he couldn't see 10 feet in front of him. Oblivious, Brooks passed to within the little 10-foot bubble of visibility. Cardus waited for just a second. Then, with his pistol drawn, he suddenly jumped out in front of him.
No! No!
Cardus reached into Brooks' pocket and took out his billfold. Opening the billfold, he smiled broadly when he saw that it was fat with banknotes. He took the money, then dropped the billfold onto Brooks' body. Moving quickly back up the cross alley, Cardus came back out onto the street. Ahead, he saw a marquee out over the sidewalk. The sign on the marquee read, Alpine Hotel. Cardus went inside. It had been a long time since he'd actually stayed in a hotel, but he had enough money to do so now, so he stepped up to the desk. There was no one there, so he waited. A man came into the hotel lobby, wearing a domed hat and a long blue coat with a double row of brass buttons. Cardus had never seen a uniformed policeman before, and for a moment he was startled, because the uniform reminded him a lot of the uniforms the guards wore back in the Yuma prison.
Evening, sir. I'm Officer Williams. Has anyone come running in here in the last few minutes?
No, I ain't seen no one. Why, what happened?
There was a murder very close to here.
Oh, did the murderer get away?
Let's just say that we haven't found him yet, but we will. In the meantime, as dark and foggy as it is outside, and with a murderer on the loose, I'd suggest that you stay inside for the night.
Well, yeah, I will.
Shortly after the policeman left, the desk clerk appeared.
I'm sorry, sir. I was temporarily detained. You been here long?
Yeah.
Well, why didn't you ring the bell?
What bell? I don't see no bell.
The clerk pointed to a small, half-round object on the desk from which a button protruded.
I'll be damned. I sure ain't never seen nothing like that.
The clerk turned the registration book around for Cardus to fill out.
Hey, am I right in thinking that a policeman was just in here?
Yeah, he just left.
What did he want?
There was a murder near here. He said we should stay inside.
Well, he ain't gotta worry. I ain't going nowhere.
The clerk took a key from a board and handed it to Cardus.
All righty. You are in room 24, second floor. All the way to the back.
Cardus paid no attention to the dozen or so roaches that started running across the floor when he lit the lantern. It also didn't bother him that the linen on the ironstead bed was dirty and had probably not been changed for several weeks. A fading brown chest of drawers was set against the wall from which hung strips of loose wallpaper. A porcelain basin and a pitcher of water was on the chest of drawers, alongside a chamber pot that reeked of urine. The window shade was badly torn and the windowpane was cracked. Curtis stood at the window for a moment, but because of the fog and darkness, he couldn't see anything. Then, turning away from the window, he sat on the bed and began counting the money he had taken from Brooks. Jamie's Ridge, named after Falcon's father, Jamie Ian McAllister, sat at the north end of McAllister Valley. Stretching across the valley, it stood like a closed door against the cold winds of winter. It didn't keep out all the cold, of course, but its effect was noticeable. Often, while neighboring counties would get 2 or 3 feet of snow, the snow falling in McAllister Valley would be calculated in inches. And during the great winter freeze-out of a few years ago, when hundreds of thousands of head of cattle died all over the West, the cattle in McAllister Valley fared surprisingly well. Falcon rode up to the crest of Jamie's Ridge, then dismounted. In his Diablo-cropped grass, Falcon sat on a large flat rock and looked out over the valley. The setting sun caught the stream that ran through the middle of the valley, turning it molten gold. And indeed, the stream was gold as far as the valley was concerned, because its inexhaustible supply of water was fully as valuable to the business of raising cattle as were the gently rolling grasslands. Anytime Falcon was home, particularly if he wanted to think about something, he would come here. In fact, he could almost believe that the rock he was sitting on was flat because he had so often sat on it. Right now, he wanted to think about what he and Coors had discussed. Did he really want to replace his Longhorns with Herefords? It wasn't entirely the business decision that caused him to pause and think. He knew that Coors was right about the value of the Herefords and the role they would play in the future of the cattle industry. Herefords would make more money, period. But money was not a problem with Falcon. He had mineral rights to gold and silver mines. In fact, the Arizona silver mine that he had recently bought from Doc Holliday was already paying off handsomely. But he liked the Longhorns. He admired their tenacity and their ability to find something to eat when the deer and the antelope couldn't. That was good for someone like him. Ever since his father and wife had been killed by renegade Indians, Falcon McAllister had been a man on the move. He didn't see that changing anytime soon. He also liked the continuity of the Longhorns. These had been the cattle of his father, and by looking at them, he could almost project himself back to a happier time when his father and his wife were both alive and he was a serious rancher. On the other hand, he felt that he owed an obligation to the valley that his father had been so instrumental in settling and building. And if his obligation was to introduce a breed of cattle that would take him into the future, then he should do so. The days of the Longhorn were numbered, and anyone who didn't make the transition into the new breed would be left behind. Falcon reached down and pulled up a stem of grass, then put the sweet root into his mouth and sucked on it.
Now wait a damn minute, Diablo. Who says that I have to get rid of my Longhorns? Why can't I raise both breeds?
Falcon knew that talking to Diablo was little more than talking to himself, but sometimes it was effective in helping him think things out. Smiling, he stood up and walked back over to Diablo. He patted the horse on the neck.
Thanks, old friend. I just needed to talk to someone who could give me a little advice. You've been very helpful.
It was midnight dark by the time the train pulled into Laramie, Wyoming, but the station platform was so brightly lit by nearly a dozen gas lamps that it shined like a golden bubble. Falcon got off the train, then walked up to the stock car to wait for Diablo to be offloaded.
Staying in town long?
Staying through the auction.
I thought maybe you were. We got a lot of people in town right now. You looking for a place to stay? Because if you need a place, my sister-in-law rents a room in her house. Meals come with it, and I can attest to the fact that she's a good cook.
Your sister-in-law?
Yeah, she's a widow now. She was married to my brother, God rest his soul.
I don't know. It probably wouldn't work out for your sister-in-law. I like to stay out late. I wouldn't want to disturb her when I come in.
No problem. The back bedroom you'd be using has its own door.
Falcon had planned to get a room in the hotel, but for some reason, he found the idea of staying in a private home appealing.
Does she have a place to put up my horse?
She has a barn out back. Clean straw in the stall and fresh hay.
Where is this place?
The station master pointed to a small, single-story wood frame house.
That's it, right across the street. Her name is Frances Martin. My name's Cody Martin. Tell her that I sent you. That way she'll know you aren't dangerous.
Well, how do you know I'm not dangerous, Cody?
Oh, you're a dangerous man, Falcon McAllister. But you're only dangerous to those folks who cross you the wrong way.
You know who I am.
Yes, sir. I'd knowed who you was the moment you stepped down from the train. I seen you in action once. Quick as thought you were. But you was in the right and the other fellow was in the wrong. No, sir. You ain't no danger to my sister-in-law. Fact is, I'd feel comforted by you staying there.
I appreciate your confidence.
Falcon threw his saddle onto Diablo's back, but he didn't cinch it down. Instead, he walked across the street leading his horse. Tying him off at the hitching post in front, Falcon walked up to the house. A young boy answered the door. Falcon guessed he was about 14.
Yes, sir?
I was told by the station master that I could rent a room here.
Mom! Don't shout so, Gordon. It's quite rude.
The station master had said that his sister-in-law was a widow, and because of that, Falcon had a preconceived notion of what she might look like. The woman who answered her son's call wasn't at all what he expected. She was probably in her early 40s, but her skin had the peaches and cream complexion of someone much younger. Her high cheekbones, green eyes, and light brown hair were combined in just the exact proportion to make her an exceptionally pretty woman. Her beauty was what Falcon would describe as classic, rather than the seductive, almost hard-edged look that was common to so many of the younger women he encountered.
Yes?
Good evening, Mrs. Martin. As I told the boy, the station master said I might be able to get a room here during my stay. He said to tell you that Cody Martin sent me.
The woman smiled, then opened the door wider.
Yes, that would be me brother-in-law. Please, come in.
Falcon picked up his grip and went inside.
The charge for the room and meals will be $2 per night, payable each day in advance. I do not allow liquor in my house, so if you intend to drink, you must go elsewhere to do so.
Fair enough. I'm told you have a room that has a private entrance. I wouldn't want to disturb the house by coming in late.
Yes, there's a private entrance.
I'll take the room, then. I'll pay for 5 days in advance.
Falcon handed the woman a $10 bill.
You don't have to pay that far in advance.
I know, but I prefer to, if you don't mind.
No, of course I don't mind, mister. I'm sorry, I don't believe you told me your name.
McAllister. Falcon McAllister.
Falcon McAllister? Are you really Falcon McAllister?
Uh-huh. That's really my name.
Wow.
I'm sorry. Is this a name I should recognize?
No, ma'am. There's no reason at all you should recognize the name.
Mom? He's just the most famous gunfighter there is, that's all.
Gunfighter?
Don't worry, Mom. He only kills bad men.
I see. Well, I suppose I should be comforted by the fact that you kill only bad men.
Oh, I'm sorry. Perhaps I should stay at the hotel. I've no wish to make you uncomfortable.
Mom!
Don't be silly. Of course you're welcome. If me brother-in-law sent you, I'm sure it will be all right. Besides, you won't be able to get a room at the hotel anyway. Apparently there is some auction about to take place, and a lot of people are in town for that.
Yeah, I'm here for the auction as well.
I don't understand. Why would a gunfighter be interested in an auction?
I'm not what you would call a full-time gunfighter.
I'm sorry, that was quite rude of me.
No apology needed. If you don't mind, I'll put my horse in the back.
I'll do it.
Well, thank you.
Falcon fished a nickel out of his pocket and gave it to Gordon.
Wow, thanks!
It's past time for supper, but if you're hungry, I could fix you something.
Oh, thank you, but that's not necessary. If you just show me to the room, I'll be fine.
After getting settled in his room, Falcon let himself out the back door and walked down the street to find a saloon. It was easy to find because of all the golden patches of light that spilled through the windows and doors of the buildings. The brightest patch lay in the street in front of a building that was identified as the Gold Strike. The piano player was taking a break, sitting with his back to his instrument, drinking a whiskey as he looked out over the customers. Falcon stepped up to the bar.
What can I get for you, friend?
A beer.
As was his habit when visiting a saloon for the first time, Falcon turned to peruse the room. At one of the tables, a lively card game was in progress. The table was crowded with brightly colored poker chips and empty beer mugs. There were two brass platoons within spitting distance of the players, but despite their presence, the floor around the table was riddled with expectorated tobacco quids and chewed cigar butts. One of the players, shaking his head in disgust, pushed his chair back and stood up.
Well, that's it for me, boys. Cards wasn't coming my way tonight. I ain't drawn a winning hand in a coon's age.
One of the players looked over toward the bar, and seeing that Falcon was watching him, called out to him. Falcon walked over to the table. The person who invited Falcon stood and extended his hand.
Name's Clyde Puckett. I work at the rolling mill.
Rolling mill?
Don't tell me you didn't see the rolling mill. Just the biggest building in the entire Wyoming territory is all. We make railroad tracks.
You evidently arrived on this evening's train. Had you arrived in the daytime, you would have been aware of its presence, not only by its size, but by the noxious smoke it spreads across our community.
That noxious smoke provides employment for 200 families.
I'm not complaining, just commenting.
Tell them the rules, Clyde.
Here's the rules. What you take out of your pocket and put in front of you is all the money you can play with. You can't go back for more. And you can't put any more in front of you than the most any of us have. We got a lot of rich folks in town now, what with this cattle auction that's coming up, and we don't aim to let anyone come in here and start buying the pot by betting any more than anyone can match.
Sounds reasonable enough to me.
And just so you know who to look out for, Mr. Bill Nye here has been the winner so far tonight.
I must confess to a bene placita with the cards.
As you no doubt gather from his Latin, Mr. Nye is a lawyer, and everybody knows what a foul profession law is.
Listen to who's talking. I ask you gentlemen in all sincerity, can you trust a representative of the press? Mr. Hayford here is a publisher of the Sentinel, our newspaper.
At least he don't send messages in code. What'd you say? A bene placito or something like that?
My dear boy, and to whom would I be sending secret messages? A bene placita is merely a Latin phrase meaning I have been well pleased with the cards.
Yeah, well, don't use any more of that. It's like you're cheating or something.
Fortunately for you, Clyde, I also believe in absit iniuria verbis. And before you fly off the handle, that means I take no insult from your words.
Mr. Nye is also the postmaster.
Former postmaster, my good man. Former postmaster. On October 1st of last year, I sent a letter to the President of the United States tendering my resignation. Perhaps you'd like to hear it.
Oh, I'd love to hear it.
Hayford's broad smile told Falcon that he had heard it before and had set this up just for Falcon's benefit. Nearly everyone in the bar, men and women, gathered around the table to listen. Nye, who was very aware that he was the center of attention, made a big show of removing a folded piece of paper from his inside jacket pocket. He slid his glasses up the bridge of his nose, then flattened the paper and looked around at his audience before he began to read.
From the postmaster, Laramie City, Wyoming Territory, to the President of the United States. Sir, I beg leave at this time to officially tender my resignation as postmaster at this place and in due form to deliver the great seal and the key to the front door of the office. The safe combination is set on the numbers 22-66-99, though I do not remember at this moment which comes first or how many times you revolve the knob or which direction you should turn it first in order to make it operate. There is some mining stock in my private drawer in the safe, which I have not yet removed. This stock you may have if you desire it. It is a luxury, but you may have it. I've decided to keep a horse instead of this mining stock. The horse may not be so pretty, but it will cost less to keep him. You will find the postal cards that have not been used under the distributing table, and the coal down in the cellar. If the stove draws too hard, close the damper in the pipe and shut the general delivery window.
Mr. President, as an official of this government, I now retire. My term of office would not expire until 1886. I must, therefore, beg pardon for my eccentricity in resigning. It would be best, perhaps, to keep the heartbreaking news of my resignation from the ears of European powers until the dangers of a financial panic are fully past. Then, hurl it broadcast with a sickening thud. Yours sincerely, Bill Nye.
Nye made a great show of bowing to his audience.
Friend, I apologize for the interruption and hope you will forgive us, but if you know anything about lawyers, you know what hands they are.
Quit wasting the man's time with bogus apologies. Do you have any questions about the rules of the game?
I take it I can match the funds of the person with the highest amount of money.
You can indeed, sir, and that would be me.
A lawyer, wearing a black suit, a shoestring tie, and a flat-crowned black hat, began counting the chips in front of him.
It would appear that I have $125 here.
Well, I won't need that much.
Falcon bought $75 worth of chips and stacked them up in front of him.